this is Revolution. No, it's not. On This Is Revolution and GTAA, this is Philosophy for the People with Ben Burgess and Stephen Bertram. And kind of for the first time, we have a guest.
We do. It's exciting. So it goes along with the essay for this week. Normally, you and I talk about whatever essay I have written that week. But this time we have a guest essay, which is a response from Tibor Rutar, who is the person I was responding to in the essay from last week. And, you know, if you want to be really dogged and determined about doing all your homework here, there I was responding to an article that he wrote for REO Magazine. So you'll get the fullest impression of things if you read all three. But
we technically had a guest before, which was when Ben wasn't here for a few weeks. So I decided to just do a show
with Doug.
And then actually Vaughn was in the chat and we're like, get Vaughn on. And so we had Vaughn and Doug. But apart from that, we haven't had a guest.
Yeah. So, yeah, exactly. And I should say also that even if you haven't done all that reading, one of the virtues of Tibor's essay this week is it really does stand on its own, right? You know, even if you hadn't read his original essay.
Yeah, I think it focuses on a different issue to your one last week, which is useful because I think the issue that Tibor talks about in the essay this week is the one I found most interesting from last week.
Well, let's do it.
Hello.
Hello. Hello, guys.
Happy to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
This week, we have an essay which is, you know, kind of recounting in part kind of a personal kind of intellectual journey of Tibor, but also focusing, I think, very much on this kind of historical question and some kind of quite thorny historical questions, kind of like deep in the Marxist literature, where there's a lot of disagreement between Marxists themselves. I was going to say this is probably going to be the most kind of sedate and boring argument about Marxism on YouTube because we're all philosophers. But then I was like, wait, Tibor seems like a sociologist. And I was like, wait, I'm a sociologist.
Oh, wow.
So maybe actually, you know, this is actually a majoritarian sociologist.
We're taking over.
Fair enough.
So, Tibor, do you want to introduce your essay and, you know, either talk about kind of your journey or just start off on historical stuff, depending on how you want to do it?
Sure. What I tried to do in the essay, I think, is, and I was prompted to do this by Ben's thinking on the matter. I think he landed some criticisms or some of his criticisms landed of my aerial piece. I thought that maybe I should say to your audience that we can look at Marxism, we can view Marxism either as a grand paradigm, which is inextricably tied to historical materialism as a theory of history or a theory of social forms. And then we can have all of those discussions that you mentioned about, well, does the theory of history really hold up? Does Cohen's rendition of it hold up? Do the various critiques or reconstructions by his colleagues hold up? So what do we think about that? And then if we put that to one side, we could also view Marxism in more, I guess, weak terms, or more pragmatist terms, that is, as an assemblage of various concepts and mechanisms that any sociologist, I guess, can use if those concepts turn out to be correct. Like, I don't know, the idea of exploitation, maybe some of the general laws of capitalist accumulation that Marx lays out in the 25th chapter of first volume of Capital. Marxist theory of state, I didn't say anything, and Ben didn't say anything either on the Marxist theory of state, but maybe that would be one way of looking at it. So Marxism is something that non-Marxists can use, and you don't need to declare yourself, I think, maybe Ben thinks otherwise, but you don't have to declare yourself a Marxist if you, for example, think that workers under capitalism are exploited, as I tend to think. And you can think that Marx said some useful stuff on that as well, I do think, without being a Marxist, right? So I think that is the general idea in my...
Yeah, we're gonna defend big Marxism or attack big Marxism today, not little Marxism.
Okay, sure. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think that... Look, it's certainly, I'm not that invested in the word. You know, I take it that the word is a sort of useful shorthand for gesturing at things that actually matter. But yeah, I mean, I think that that, you know, like, it's a really, you know, it's a nicely structured essay. I think it makes things very, very clear. I think it's much, you know, there are definitely parts of your view that are much clearer to me, you know, and would be, even if we hadn't talked on Monday, that from, you know, from this essay that that wouldn't have been from the Ario essay. And I am curious at a few points how, you know, how, you know, some of the claims in the two relate to each other. I think there might be an interesting discussion to be had about that. But yeah, I mean, I should also say, even though it's a little bit of a different subject from the main one that we're talking about, just to give people sort of a good idea of where you're coming from. I mean, I was almost thinking, as you're saying, you know, workers are exploited under under capitalism, and in the Ario essay, I kind of got the impression that you thought that this was true, sort of in some cases, you know, or sort of very contingently as a result of like state failure. But in the Philosophy for the People essay, I think you I think you do embrace a much more general claim, right? But the analogy I was almost thinking about is, it's like the Buddha's noble truths, right? You know, all life is suffering. Suffering can be overcome, right? You know, so in this case, the Marxist noble truth you maybe accept is that workers are exploited under capitalism. But then the second question is, okay, can that be overcome? And that might be where there are interesting disagreements, and, you know, maybe one of the places where the rubber meets the road, because, you know, you do say, I think very correctly at the beginning of the essay, that that one shouldn't sort of sign on to Marxism's descriptive claims out of loyalty to the, you know, to like the normative goal of socialism. And that seems totally right to me, that, you know, you could obviously, there were socialists before Marx, you know, you could obviously be a socialist without being, you know, without being a Marxist. I mean, like, what this is supposed to be is a descriptive framework that's supposed to help you understand the world in ways that are helpful for achieving that normative goal. But also, your sort of journey away from Marxism has been fairly complete. It hasn't taken you to the right wing. You know, you're still a, you know, social democrat, but and it hasn't even taken you entirely away from like descriptive materialism. But it has taken you away both from the sort of central descriptive claims of Marxism, or at least, you know, some big important ones, and also away from the normative goal that grounds it all, right? Like you had in our discussion on Monday, you had, one of the books you recommended was Lane Kenworthy, I believe, Would Democratic Socialism Be Better, which you know, I managed to read not the whole thing, but the first couple chapters of in preparation for today, you know, to get a better sense of where you're coming from, and that's an explicit argument that the sort of, you know, best of all possible worlds, or at least if it's not in some ultimate sense, the sort of realistically best of all possible worlds, maybe, is basically capitalism with social democratic characteristics, right? So there's a sort of parallel motion on the level of political goals from where they were, you know, where your political goals were in, like, say, 2013, extremely Marxist Tibor, to where they are now, and in descriptive framework from Marxism to this kind of post-Marxist, very Weber-influenced, kind of broadly materialist, but not really, you know, not really in the grandiose way that Marxism is, you know, view that you would hold now.
I think that you laid it out perfectly. In response, I think I would say I would follow your structure, and I would say first that descriptively, I guess, and this comes across, I think, in the essay as well, what most bothers me now or has been bothering me for the past 5 years is the idea of the causal or explanatory primacy of class. I either don't know what that means, if it's vague enough, or if it's made more precise, I think it falls into the trap of reductionism or determinism. So we can explore that. And we could even, yep. When I was reading up for our conversation today, we could delve a bit into the issue of the Marxist theory of the state, because I guess that was one of the more convincing ideas behind the principle of explanatory primacy of class, aside from the theory of social forms, which I cover in the essay, that convinced me in the past, the Marxist theory of the state, that the economic sort of predominates or class relations are more important than anything else for the social dynamic in capitalism. So that's one thing. And then the other, the more political normative, I would say two things in response to that. So first, I was a revolutionary. 5 years ago or 10 years ago, I thought that social democracy was off the table for me. And when some of my colleagues said, "We are sure, Tibor, we are socialists, but I mean, we can get there by electoral means. I mean, do you really think that a revolution, probably a violent, at least in parts, violent revolution, which would expropriate the expropriators in the 21st century, do you really think that people would get behind that? And do you really want that, Tibor? I mean, civil wars, I guess, and so on." And I just didn't bother myself too much with that question. And then at some point, I thought to myself, yeah, you're right. First of all, it doesn't seem that workers in Slovenia or the UK or the US would be willing to enact a revolution. More than half of them are part of the middle class, and those are not all that revolutionary. And the 30 to 40% of the still, I guess, the older sort of industrial working class, they're more conservative, I guess, than socialists, definitely not revolutionary in the sense that I wanted them to be. And then the second thing was, I thought to myself, even if we managed to convince them to enact a revolution, I mean, the Slavoj Žižek question, what would happen the day after? Again, not something I bother myself too much with in the past. We usually, on our seminars and panels, we just said, look, Marx told us that there are no cookbooks of the future. The priests in feudalism didn't know what's coming to them. The merchants, which helped prop up capitalism, didn't know what's coming. So why would we now invent this grand plan or recipe? We'll just see how things turn out as we go along. And that, again, I realized I don't think that's quite right. So I abandoned my revolutionary pretensions. And then the second thing I wanted to say is that in regards to in regards to social democracy, I think there are limits to social democracy. I think in certain aspects it doesn't go far enough. And then in that sense, I'd say we have to, like I did on Monday, we have to experiment with economic democracy more than social democrats are willing to. But your proposal, like I said on Monday, your proposal that economic democracy is not just something we'd experiment with, it would have to be mandated. It would have to be much more radical than just a social democrat like me would probably say. Maybe make some state incentives for firms to be economically democratic. Again, there I start asking myself as a faculty professor, God damn it, I sort of am right now quote unquote enjoying economic democracy as a faculty professor, and I freaking hate it.
I am with you there, right? So I will say, as a I've actually said this many times in the last 8 years that I have that the experience, not that I've had to in recently, right? You know, but back in the period of my life when I did, the experience of sitting through faculty meetings has actually reshaped my ideas about what socialism could or should be like. I think that I actually take, in fact, I will say, another clever Slovenian has a good lecture that you can find on YouTube called A Plea for Bureaucratic Socialism, where he makes the point, for example, that, you know, he doesn't want to go to mass meetings to have a radical democratic control over how the water, sewer, and electric systems work. He wants his relationship with these things to be never having to think about them. Yeah. And I think there's really something to that. I actually do think when we start to drill into the specifics of what socialism could look like and what should look like, what we would want it to look like, I do think that there are some real limitations on the desirability of direct democracy. Mm-hmm. But of course, I would point out that, you know, let's say there's a spectrum leading from direct democracy, where everything is always being decided by mass meetings, to what you have under capitalism, which is that key economic decision makers have essentially no democratic accountability to mm-hmm. the people that they're ruling over. And I think none is far too little, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and we could get into that. I will just say really quickly and programmatically that I agree with you on the cookshops question. That's why something mm-hmm. like that Lane Kenworthy book is like a sort of important challenge to my view, because mm-hmm. I do actually think we need cookshops for the recipes for the cookshops of the future, if only to assure people they'll have something to eat. And
I was really glad that Tibor pronounces cookbook the same way I do.
And I should also say, I mean, it's kind of funny listening to you talk about this, because one thing that really hits me just biographically is that, again, on both the sort of level of normative political goals and on the level of descriptive analysis, in certain respects, I think over the last, you know, probably similar period of time, I've stayed at a similar level of Menshevism, whereas you probably started out, you know, more hardcore than me, and then yeah. like much further in the other direction, right? You know, so I think that, I tend to agree with the sort of analysis that like Bhaskar Sankara gives in the Socialist mm-hmm. Manifesto, that the sort of most realistic scenario for the achievement of post-capitalist economic structures would start out with a whole lot of, you know, with pushing to the edges of what can be accomplished under social democracy, to the point where you sort of force a situation where the only way to safeguard what's been achieved is to go further. And also on this, again, the same is true at the descriptive level of analysis, because, you know, if you're watching this, and I know that a certain percentage of our viewers are going to fall into this category, and you think, yeah, so Ben believes in this dumb Anglo-American, like...
I was going to say, there's a good portion of our audience who think Ben isn't a Marxist. Exactly.
Yeah, I know.
I'm the only Marxist on the show.
Yeah, exactly. I guess so.
Exactly, right? So, you know, that's like, oh, yeah, you believe in this, like, watered-down Anglo-American crap, this analytical Marxism that's not the real Marxism, that's, you know, dialectical and holist and all that. And one thing I would say, you know, I'll skip the defense of myself for another time and just go to you, is that on this question, one of the things that makes you an interesting interlocutor is that your sort of journey on this has kind of passed through both. That you know, something you, I think, say in the guest post on the Substack, and certainly I've heard you say otherwise, you do say it in the Substack, right? Is you're somebody who really knows your value theory literature, you know, that, you know, you've all of the stuff that, you know, that portion of our audience is convinced that I haven't properly absorbed and, you know, should agree with if I had, you know, your Heinrich and Kleiman and all that stuff, right? You know, this was also a big thing in your stage of development, right? So, so you, in fact, I think you kind of started out there before discovering like analytical and political Marxism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Although I think the audience will not be satisfied with my reasons for abandoning that part of Marxism, because I started abandoning it under the influence of political and analytical Marxism. It just didn't seem, when I read those guys, it just didn't seem analytical enough or empirically grounded enough. And I adored, in 2012, I adored Isaac Ilich Rubin and his essays on the theory of value. And then going over them again a few years later under the influence of Eric Wright or John Romer or John Elster, I have to say that they were they were one of the reasons why I abandoned that part of the project. So I guess analytical Marxism corrupted me in that sense. But I never took seriously, I guess like you, Ben, I never took seriously complaints that analytical Marxism is neither analytical, neither Marxism, or it is bourgeois Marxism. What some of my colleagues at the time, so 5-7 years ago, they've written a few books, and in those books they say, and then you have this other school of Anglo-Saxon positivist analytical Marxism who are basically just bourgeois protectors of the middle class. And I don't know, just my personality, this disposition, I guess, never made me amenable to those kind of arguments. So I don't know if I'm the correct intermediary here. I think I'm too much on your side for me to offer you protection.
I'm just saying, at the very least, nobody should get the impression that you are, you're rejecting this because you haven't been exposed to the real uncut, you know, pure Colombian Marxism.
That's not at all the case.
I think there are a couple of ways that this could go. Mm-hmm. I'm very happy to recap some of the history stuff we were arguing about.
Sure.
Monday. It was
neat because the solution that I was mentioning, kind of the natural selection of capitalism, was the solution that Tibor mentioned in his essay, which he found satisfying at least for capitalism, but not for kind of the history of all modes of production or whatever.
Yeah.
But that was just, I just happened upon that idea, so that was neat.
Awesome. And you haven't read the reference, so Alan Carling and stuff. Oh, okay, that's nice.
Yeah. So, okay. On that, it's funny too, actually, because I will say that some of those people that you're talking about who would say, it's like, oh, this like Anglo-Saxon positivist stuff and, you know, Marxist clothing. I think that would be very untroubled by some of the questions that you're concerned about the theory of history, but because I don't agree with them, I think you're right to be troubled by them. And I think that the, in my experience, at least some of those people will sort of shrug on some of the primacy questions and say, well, you know, they're dialectically, you know, interrelated, and that's sort of all you have to say. But I think you, again, I mean, for my money, you know, we can get a third perspective from Stefan, but for my money, that sort of misses the point for two reasons. One is that, it's just not very informative, to say that. And two, you know, some of these primacy claims sure seem to matter for Marx. Like he seems to, you know, certainly, you know, we mean a couple different things by the theory of history, which is also, I think, comes out a little bit in this essay. And I think that you state the claim more strongly than I would. And so that might be part of our difference. But you say that there's sort of class relations are going to be in some important way the kind of primary explanation of any kind of macro level big phenomenon, which I think certainly if what you mean by Marx's theory of history is primarily what Cohen is talking about in Karl Marx's theory of history, that's primarily taken from that kind of canonical expression in that 1859 preface. And that doesn't claim that, right? What that claims is two things. One is that the class relations are going to be the sort of big driving explanation of why you have a certain set of legal and political institutions.
Mm-hmm.
And two is that those class relations themselves are going to be primarily driven by the development of the forces of production, which you know, neither of those is quite this, you know, like is quite as strong as saying like sort of any big macro development will be primarily explained in that. Now, I think that if you accept this sort of more strictly delineated view, it would be reasonable to expect that, look, if this is the primary thing that's driving these sort of massively important changes in the whole foundations of society, then it's a reasonable expectation that they're going to at least tell us a lot mm-hmm. about any given macro level phenomenon. But I don't think you necessarily need to have the sort of primacy claim there in every case, but maybe this is just cope. Let's go to you to kind of get some thoughts on that.
Yeah, you're right. This is the crucial issue. I mean, my views on that were, I guess, formed by the following developments. So first of all of the Marxists that I read and respected, starting with Wright, but also Chibber and so on, Alex Kalinikos. Kalinikos definitely represents a very different strand of Marxism to American analytical Marxists, but I think he's still an important contemporary Marxist. All of them constantly disparaged neo-Weberians like Michael Mann and others, and constantly just drilled in my head that we have to defeat the neo-Weberians, who are just these methodological pluralists who say, yeah, class is important sometimes, but other times it's not important, and so on. And so I really, when writing my PhD and in my books and my articles, I really always had this shadow of neo-Weberians. How can we show that they're mistaken, that class, of course, it's not reductively important, but it's much more important than they say. Let's leave it at that. So that's one thing. The other thing is that neo-Weberians themselves, if you go, for example, read Michael Mann's volume 4 of The Sources of Social Power, at the end he says, let's settle the issue of ultimate determination. In my other volumes, I didn't say anything on that. The reader could glean my thoughts on the matter from my empirical observations, but let me now make a statement. And he makes the following statement. He says, Weber was wrong to say that we cannot venture any historical generalizations. I myself have ventured them, and Weber is just wrong. But Marx is equally as wrong that we can say that ultimately the economic aspect of life, either in the sense of forces of production or relations of production, is in some overarching way determinative. So that again just confirmed in me the idea that, okay, so the delineation between Marxism and Weberianism as its main rival has to do with this importance of class relations. And then the last idea, I guess, would be that a Giddens quote came to mind. So Anthony Giddens is this famous British sociologist who wrote two volumes of a book titled A Contemporary Critique of Historical Materialism. And I have this quote in front of me. It's a short quote. Let me just read that. And I think, again, you'll get the sense of where I'm coming from. So he says, Marx's writers these days are much less prone than once was the case to engage in crude forms of class reductionism, but there does seem to be a bottom line, according to which to be a Marxist at all, at some level, the thesis of the primacy of class must be sustained. For me, such a position is inherently far too limiting. So he wrote that in response to his critics, which include Cohen and Kalinikos and Wright. This was in the late 1980s. And again, this just reaffirmed my sense of we have to get around this idea of class, of the explanatory primacy of class relations. You say, maybe this is just scope, Tibor, because now I'm saying that you don't need that to be a Marxist. Now, my response to you would be, I don't know if it's scope. I myself am not sure. But maybe I just wanted to make your audience aware, and I'm really interested in what Stefan, because you say that he comes from a different perspective, would say on this. I just wanted to make your audience and my Marxist colleagues, I guess, aware that, guys, there is something to this controversy. We have to get that down before we proceed with our pronouncements that Marxism is triumphant and that Weberians are just these bourgeois sociologists who are blind to exploitation and the importance of class. I guess so. Stefan?
I mean, I definitely 100% agree that I think there's a lot of, I think it's much better to take your position where you kind of retreat from these essential kind of positions of Marxism, traditional positions of Marxism, to then stop calling yourself a Marxist and what I think lots and lots of people do, mm-hmm. where they abandon value theory first, which Ben does, but that's fine. But then you abandon kind of the historical primacy of class, and you keep abandoning this stuff, and mm-hmm. you keep calling yourself a Marxist. And I think I agree with you, that's very strange. And I think it's quite common in sociology because, you know, you employ the kind of like Marxist-inspired methods or something like this. But in the end, that's not enough, I think. I agree with you to make you a Marxist. But I guess I think it would be good for you to outline like what you think, how in which ways kind of, well the idea, one idea of, I guess, class, but also the kind of mode of production, how you think, the Marxist idea is that history is driven by changes in the mode of production. Mm-hmm. But there's a problem where it's like, well, why does the mode of production change? And kind of one idea which was mentioned is kind of, you know, methods of production proliferate, say, and there's some kind of natural selection by states which adopt certain methods, which incline them towards capitalism, can then do brutal global imperialism and defeat everyone else. And transform mm-hmm. various slave societies and feudal societies into capitalist societies. And that basically is what seemed to happen in our world. That kind of capitalism emerged somewhere and was just so much brutally better than everything else. I mean, you do say in the essay, you know, you kind of emphasize in some ways the non-brutal parts of capitalism. And I agree with you. You talk about spread democracy and so on. Mm-hmm. I'm a real Marxist, so I think capitalism is great too. The second best idea anyone's ever came up with. But I guess it would be good for you to outline why you think this explanation of mm-hmm. succeeds here, or if it does succeed here, but it doesn't fail to rescue historical materialism in general, because it empirically there isn't this evidence, I think you were suggesting, for like transitions between other modes of production mm-hmm. and not just feudalism to capitalism.
Yeah, and again, this is weird because political Marxists like Ben Oteschke, I think at Sussex, and Hannes Lacher, who is in Canada, in Toronto, I think, reading their historical sociology, which is inspired by Alan Mikeson's Wood and by Robert Brenner, they go to great lengths, both theoretically and empirically, to show that in pre-capitalist times, the differences in the sophistication of technology and the productive capacity of the economy are just not large enough so that, for example, feudal modes of production would outcompete tributary modes of production, or vice versa, or that slavery would get outcompeted. They just say, look, that doesn't work. That is too Cohenite. What we would in place say is that class struggle, the contingencies of class struggle is what determines these transitions. So in a sense, we have a non-determinist theory. We just say, look, peasants will resist lords and kings, and slaves will resist slaveholders. And then sometimes some of those groups win out, and they win out in different ways. And maybe the responses of the lordship to the peasant resistance would then unintendedly result in a transition to a different mode of production. And I can get behind that. But again, we come to the question, is that really Marxist? So as I was reading Michael Mann and Anthony Giddens and all these Weberians, like I said in the essay, they say the same things. They don't call it class struggle because they also bring in bishops. And I guess because they don't think that kings are a part of the economic class, right? They would say that they're a part of both the political and the economic class. Knights and so on. So they bring in many other actors than just lords and peasants or slaves and slaveholders. And that made me think, okay, maybe I shouldn't call this class struggle, although let's keep calling it class struggle, for example. And then another question popped up, and that is also evident in what you were just saying, Stefan, and that is, wait, why do we even categorize societies by their mode of production? That would make sense in the capitalist times, right? Because the mode of production is so immensely powerful that this process of natural selection kicks in. Sure, but in pre-capitalist societies, why do we say that our framework, that our overarching framework is based in modes of production? Why not modes of persuasion or modes of political centralization, decentralization. So
stuff explaining in terms of states, right?
Exactly. So that, again, coming from a Marxist angle, made me think, at least in pre-capitalist society, am I unwittingly, and have I been unwittingly all this time, a Weberian? And if not, what is the criterion that would make my Weberian colleagues drop their jaws on the table and say, God damn it, Tibor, yeah, you're right. We fucked up. We Weberians are actually Marxists in disguise, not vice versa. So that would be one issue. Now, the other thing we could explore, but this is then relegated to the capitalist times, is, like I mentioned before, the Marxist theory of state, because that was another big, I think, argument for me when I was a Marxist to keep insisting on this idea of the primacy of class relations. I thought to myself, wait, isn't at least in capitalism the case that the economic sphere has a more fundamental influence on politics than vice versa? Because economics, the mode of production, limits what is capable, what state managers can do, what state policy can actually achieve because of a business confidence, right? A big influence on me in this regard was Fred Bloch's essay, The Ruling Class Does Not Rule, which was reproduced, I think, a year ago in Jacobin. And that just resonated with me. Wait, so state managers in the final instance have to defer to whom? Well, to the business class, because if they stop business activity, if they stop investment, if they threaten them with capital flight or with an investment strike, you don't get taxes, because in the end, all taxes come from capitalist investment. So who holds the levers of power in capitalism in the last instance? It seems that capitalists do. But then again, ironically, Wright and colleagues in Reconstructing Marxism made me think that this is not the right way of going about it. I think the Marxist theory of state is correct, by the way, but I don't think it justifies the explanatory primacy of class. Why? Well, because Wright and colleagues say that if you want to justify the explanatory primacy of class, you can't rely on what they call qualitative asymmetries between sources of power, but rather on quantitative asymmetries. What is the difference? So qualitative asymmetries are when you say that one source of power limits the other, while the other source of power, in this sense, political power, doesn't limit the first one. But they say this is not enough to ground primacy. You need to show quantitatively that one of these sources of power is more causally predominant. And the Marxist theory of state doesn't do that. It just shows that there are limits of economics on politics and not vice versa. So this is one thing. And then just one more thing, and then I'm finished. And this goes to the credit here goes to Weberians. So reading Michael Mann's Sources of Social Power, he says, wait a second, is it true that economics in capitalism limits politics, but not vice versa? And he says, not really. First of all, read the VOC literature, the varieties of capitalism literature. You have all of these different nation states with vastly different capitalisms. Just think of China's capitalism. In China, it seems prima facie that political state managers are more important in the last instance than capitalists. They hold the levers of the state. In Western democracies, it might be different. But again, this made me realize, wait, yeah, you're right. The economic sphere is not necessarily the limit of the politic of the political sphere and not vice versa. And the second thing he says is in actuality, all of these different interest groups that influence state managers, apart from capitalists, which don't have necessarily anything to do with class, can at certain point erase, for example, or gender special interest groups, can be much more at certain historical conjectures, much more important causally for state managers' decisions and state policy than capitalists. And again, doesn't that dissolve a bit the idea that capitalists in the end are the most powerful actors? I don't know if it does, but these are the misgivings I guess I'm having.
Yeah, so a couple things. One, I want to go back to what Stefan said and just say, you know, I don't think what he said is necessarily wrong, depending on how you understand it, but I think it could be misunderstood. I think a lot of people assume that I think, like, you know, value theory, you know, I think classical Marxist value theory is wrong. That's not my position. Never has been. My position is I have no idea. I had there's a time in my life when, you know, if you'd asked me, do you believe in labor theory of value, I would have said yes. But reading Cohen convinced me that I was just confused when I said that. because, and I think this is incredibly common among grassroots Marxists, what I really meant was that I accepted a sort of trivial claim, which is essentially the labor theory of the stuff that has, the things that have value, which is just sort of, you know, vacuously true. Although I think in combination with a couple of other assumptions, more than enough to get you to make most of the arguments about exploitation and all that go through. As far as, you know, actually doing things like really digging into reading, you know, those opening chapters of Capital, made it very clear to me that what exactly we're even talking about when we talk about value in this sense is an incredibly vexed question, and there's this vast literature on it, and I don't know. I know I'm in the opinion having business, but I don't have opinions about everything. Two other quick footnoting points about Weber. It is interesting to me, given, of course, that Weber is profoundly influenced by Marx. There's mm-hmm. sort of, it's like, hey, you have all these Marx influence claims that seem right, but, you know, you can, I mean, I guess it establishes that you can think that some of those are right without going all the way to being a Marxist, but I do think that...
is the conclusion of the show that Weber is actually a Marxist?
Yeah, exactly. not only is we all Marxists and Tibor is a Marxist again, but even Weber is a Marxist. Yeah. Also thought, man, I really want to see Tibor and Vivek Chibber have a conversation about uh-huh. this. I know he's been really influential on you. You cite him several times in your essay. My larger grumpy critique of some of this is that you seem to be very very compelled by within the family criticisms of Marxism, but then it's like, hold on, but like Chibber and Eric Oldright and all these people also have all these defenses of Marxist ideas that we don't really get a lot of engagement with, right? What about that part? Why? What about the fact that, you know, Wright, for example, you know, might be drawing the boundaries for class analysis in a slightly different way, but like he still thinks these are innately, you know, relations of exploitation, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But in any case, in Chibber's case specifically, I have it on good back channel authority that he's read everything by Weber and regards it as, and I quote, mid. That'd be an interesting discussion to look at. Really quickly, more substantively though, on what you're saying about the theory of history and sort of whether, explanations that, you know, like you, because you said for the transition of feudalism to capitalism, you know, you think this sort of geopolitical competition mm-hmm. Explanation makes a lot of sense. My own view would be that I think that, I think there are enough different ways that like one system doing a better job than another system of unleashing the forces of production can lead different countries to adopt it over time. Mm-hmm. I don't think you need one causal mechanism. I think there are a number of different tributaries leading from that river to that sea, including the fact that if you're better developing the forces of production, that has the sort of military advantages that Stefan emphasized. The fact that there's a sort of obvious incentive for people who might hold power within other systems to turn themselves from, you know, aristocrats to capitalists, for example, because they know that they'll be able to personally benefit, you know, from these advances, the desire to trade with people who are already capitalists, et cetera, there are lots of them. I think geopolitical competition can capture a bunch of them. I'm not sure it's like the singular thing for all of it. And I would argue that you do have certainly at least if you have a four-stage schematic, right? So the way that, you know, people who've seen, like, I don't know, they had these in like Soviet classrooms and stuff, that sort of chart with like primitive communism and slavery and feudalism and capitalism. And if you have like a really accurate chart, you might also do something about the no longer politically correct term Asiatic despotism, you know, put that somewhere in there, you know. If you simplify it, and I have mixed feelings, but in the 2000 edition of Karl Marx's Theory of History, you know, Cohen sort of suggests this at one point. It's not clear to me how committed he is to it, right? But certainly, at least if you simplify that to a four-stage schematic of primitive communism, pre-capitalist class society, capitalism, and socialism, that, you know, the three transitions that you would have are primitive communism to pre-capitalist class society, pre-capitalist class society to capitalism, and, you know, inshallah, capitalism to socialism. Then I think it is certainly plausible with regard to both of the first two, that there are any number of these advantages, that if you have settled societies that are building a lot up through extraction, exploitation, in various sort of slave and tributary sort of forms, that does give you various advantages. I mean, it's not just a sort of weird fluke that there are very so few hunter-gatherers left in the world, and there were so few hunter-gatherers left in the world, relatively speaking, at least, you know, other than in, you know, my part of the world, because Europeans haven't gotten there yet, but before the rise of capitalism, that there is a sort of systematic advantage of pre-capitalist class societies over hunter-gatherer kind of primitive communism that helped to lead that to flourish. We've sort of agreed on feudalism to capitalism, and then I guess the complicated remaining case would be capitalism to socialism. But last point about this, on the okay, but is it Marxism question, for at least for the question of is the sort of thing to be explained here, the sort of way the process plays out in individual countries, you know, the way, for example, capitalism gets its initial foothold in England, or is the thing to be explained why, in that example, capitalism becomes the globally predominant mode of production. And look, I can understand how somebody could, you know, interpret this textual evidence differently, but I would at least point out on Marx grounds that there is at least some reason to think that Marx understood the claim about transition between modes of production in that second way. And so what I'm thinking about here is the third transition, the transition from capitalism to socialism, and in particular, Marx's late writings on Russia, you know, his letter to Vera Zasulich, the introduction to the 1880, whatever it was, edition of the Communist Manifesto in Russian, where he, these places where he says, yeah, sure, there's nothing inevitable about Russia following the same developmental path as Western Europe. It could be the case that these peasant communes in Russia, that, you know, they could like skip straight from that, you know, to socialism if a revolution in Russia is a signal for a revolution everywhere else. So you have essentially, the idea would seem to be that this sort of peasant commune proto-socialism in Russia gets hooked up to and integrated to this technologically advanced industrialized socialism coming from Western Europe. And, you know, whatever else you want to say about that, and, you know, whether there was any scenario where he could have been right about it or whatever, it's certainly, the idea there does seem to be, I mean, you can take that in at least two ways. One is, you could take that, and to be fair, I think this is the way that probably a lot of people do, as Marx retreating somewhat from his historical determinism.
Right. I think the last time we talked about this, I said, you know, this was Marx not being Marxist enough, and also he was wrong. So he should be Marxist.
I mean, I think he was probably wrong, right? But I'm going to push back a little bit against this is Marx not being Marxist enough, because if you take the thing to be explained in the theory of transitions between modes of production as being the global level question, right, then this is Marx still being fairly Marxist, you know, that it's you know, because he's not retreating from the claim that you need this advanced industrial development to have global socialism. You know, he's just saying, you know, that the way that things play out in different individual countries, that there's no particular guarantee. You know, there are no particular guarantees about that.
I think my solution to kind of the point that Tibor points out of feudalism not seeming kind of historically to be, you know, to overcome in general slave societies or however you want to term it, is just to sacrifice feudalism. I'm very happy to sacrifice feudalism as like a real mode of production. Like, I think it's fake. This might be a time when Marx was actually being Eurocentric. Well, it never became a global system. I think feudalism was just like a contingent kind of thing which happened in some places in the world. And each instance of feudalism isn't that we call feudalism isn't actually that similar to each other.
True.
Can I ask a quick clarificatory question about that? When you say that, is the idea that feudalism isn't sort of a robustly independent mode of production as opposed to ancient slave societies, etc.? In other words, that it's all kind of the same big thing? Or is the idea like some sort of pre-capitalist equivalent of like the Hillel Tikhtin kind of view about the Soviet Union, that there's like no mode of production, it hasn't, you know, it hasn't settled on one yet, something like that?
No, one point is kind of like an epistemic one. I think the kind of my retreat from Marxism that I do, or condemning what others retreat, is to retreat completely from kind of what Engels said, where, you know, he tried to broaden Marxism out from historical materialism to dialectic materialism, where it applied not just to sociology and history, but to the entire scape of the universe, but also to kind of constrain the historical dimensions, which is to say that Marxism is a very good theory for the transition to capitalism and the parts of capitalism we've been in, and hopefully the transition to socialism. And that makes perfect sense based on it having this kind of the data that was available to Marx and to subsequent people. But it's not going to be a terrible, likely theory about the transition between, if there is, between slave societies and feudalism. Because for these kind of transitions, we just don't have any significant data at all. That would be my epistemic scientific point. You can't have really a scientific theory of the transition between slave societies and feudalism, if that is a proper transition, because we don't have the data, and we will never have the data outside of Nick Bostrom kind of historical simulations.
Which kind of data? Like, I think I got lost in that last argument.
The constant, the massive amount of numbers that Marx deploys in Das Kapital, these numbers are not available and will never be available for, you know, trying to study the transition in Europe in the 9th century.
So between the
Roman manorial system and early feudalism. We'll never ever have that data.
Okay, so like data on like on things.
Yeah, like how many pots of olive oil they produced that year.
Okay.
Like Marx has that data in 1850, and one has that data in 850 and never will.
Okay, now I understand. I don't know that I have a dog in this fight, but I'm going to be very curious to hear what Tibor says.
Yeah, but yeah.
The other point is to say that, I think feudalism is fake in the sense that you describe.
In the first,
it's probably. I'm inclined to think that it's probably not a real mode of production. In a very kind of unjustified way, because it failed to overcome slave societies universally, it isn't, and that's definitely bad science. It's not a real
mode. So there are a couple different claims there, but I think one of them is kind of the one that I floated earlier, that we should maybe see like relations of just direct extraction as like one big thing, right?
I don't think that, and I think I think there's a lot to say, and the last thing I'll say before just letting Tibor talk is I think there's something very, very interesting about feudalism, that depending how you cut it, feudalism never produced a state. Or if there was, like, if the French absolutists were a state, then it was like a late transition of feudalism out of feudalism. But slave societies produced long-standing, centuries-long states, the Roman state and the Chinese state, which, depending on how you cut it, lasted a very, very long time, is the longest state period of history, happened within slave societies. And surely states and capitalism, they seem very important together. And there's obviously all these theories about could China or Rome, under the right circumstances, have transitioned from slave society to capitalism? And yeah, so that's not much of a definitive statement, but that's kind of how I've started to think about these things very recently. I was literally talking about it yesterday.
Okay.
That's very interesting. Yeah, yeah. I'm not necessarily opposed to that, although I've read enough of Chris Wickham, the preeminent Marxian of the feudal age, that I don't know if I'm willing to abandon feudalism as a mode of production, but definitely interesting thoughts, Stefan, and limiting Marxism's scope as a theory of history to after the transition to capitalism and then on. That's an interesting idea. Yeah, I would have to think about that a bit more. Now, I have a few comments on what both of you said. So with regards to the theory of history and what Ben was saying, maybe primitive communism is exactly the type of society, we have to admit that represents 200,000 years of human history or prehistory, right? Sure. Before the emergence of classes and so on. So a big chunk of history. I think that precisely the fact that hunter-gatherers don't seem to have this pervasive tendency of which Cohen speaks, this human, the philosophical anthropology of saying that there is an interest in reducing the burden of toil by increasing productive capacity, one of the main mechanisms with which Cohen undergirds his theory. That, again, makes me a bit queasy about the general validity of historical materialism as laid out by Cohen, because if people for 200,000 years didn't have this overriding interest, they were just fine by working 4 to 5 hours a day, having their primitive tools, and that's it. And 200,000 years went by. So I think Marxists have to wrestle with that. Then another thing is, again, I would blame Marxists for deconverting me. Robert Branner was the guy that mostly influenced me in my thinking about pre-capitalist societies, and his constant emphasis how these societies are almost completely technologically stagnant. Millennia go by without any significant development, and then when developments in the forces of production do happen, those are, as Branner calls them, one-off, just one-off developments, and that's it, complete contingency. That, again, is something I think Marxists like Chibber, who is a student of Branner's, will have to contend with, or because they're switching over from historical materialism into the theory of social forms or the theory of class struggle, that would probably not bother them, but they would have to deal with the charge of contingency, that their theory is reduced to just saying, well, you know, transitions happen when they happen due to reasons that are important, and that's it. I think they can maybe overcome that contention, but it's interesting to note how Marxists themselves, in a way, maybe perhaps shot themselves in the foot by emphasizing how stagnant pre-capitalist societies are. Although I think Branner is completely empirically correct, and I still do hold to that. The last thing I'll say on the theory of history, we should take seriously what Chibber says, channeling Alan Carling in that article, What is Living and What is Dead in the Marxist Theory of History, when he mentions Vietnam and what a mockery it made, that sort of primitive socialist society, what a mockery it made of the most developed hegemonic capitalist society in the world, that is the US, right? The US lost the war against North Vietnam. And of course, one can say, well, a primitive society defeating a technologically extremely sophisticated society, those are rare. Yeah, sure. But again, if we find enough instances of that, and I think in history, especially in pre-capitalist history, there's loads of instances of less developed societies overtaking, for at least a few thousand years, overtaking more developed societies. We have to wrestle with that. Now, just two quick comments on, maybe just one quick comment on value theory going all the way back. I am not necessarily opposed. It's not that I discovered this one one brief proof against value theory. It's more that I was studying it for 2 to 3 years, just studying completely just value theory, all different strands. Roberto Veneziani and the Sraffians on the one hand, Ian Steedman on the one hand, Kleiman and the temporal single system interpretation on the other hand. Then you have Robert Brenner with his weird amalgamation of value theory with neoclassical economics. Then you have value form theorists like Michael Heinrich and the Neue Marx Lektüre. Then you have other Marxists. Just, I realized at some point, not that I have a good argument against value theory, it just, I was dismayed about how big of a controversy there is on value theory between Marxists, how they can't basically agree on anything, and how hostile they are one to another. How Kleiman just completely despises Brenner and Ian Steadman and the Straffians, and not just that they're not Marxist, but they're completely mistaken in their interpretation of Marx, which I would say, come on, dude, I mean, they probably got some bits correct. And they return fire in a similar way. And I'm trying to say that I backed off from value theory and I have no inclination of going back in, simply because there's so much confusion, disagreement, and especially interpretive, exegetical disagreement. And that just, it puts me off, right? What Marx really said in chapter 4 of the Theories of Surplus Value in an unpublished manuscript where he has some algebra, I don't know if that's productive.
Yeah, I definitely get that. So I did have just a, since I know, you know, it's even later in Slovenia than it is in the UK, and so I know our time together is coming to an end, and I wanted to make sure I slipped this in before we got there. I mean, I did just had a bigger picture, you know, question, I guess, about something you said a while ago, which is, why is it that we're this concerned about relations of production in the first place, as opposed to, you know, political relations, as opposed to, you know, very, you know, there are all sorts of different ways you could slice up societies in principle. I'm not actually sure off the top of my head that, you know, I have a wonderful argument on this, but I do certainly have a very strong knee-jerk intuition that when you kind of look around at the world, both now and historically, that, you know, this does seem like the most important difference between kinds of societies that, you know, even though, by the way, I would agree with you for more or less boringly classical Marxist reasons that that, you know, there is certainly a non-coincidental relationship between, you know, capitalism and the spread of democracy, that, you know, there's a reason you don't get a lot of democracy plus feudalism. But you look around at the current
state societies, though.
You look around at the world today, yes, some democracy in slave societies, although I think non-coincidental limitations on that compared to what's made possible under a different mode of production. But, you know, certainly you look around the capitalist world today and, you know, you see, countries with wildly different political arrangements to a point, right, that you know, certainly... You have many cases now or recently where capitalist production relations are sure combined with democracy, or combined with military dictatorship, are combined with Islamic theocracy, or combined with all sorts of things. I mean, to a point actually that it creates its own headaches, right, for a Marxist analysis, which I know is something you'd emphasize, but you do see quite a bit of variation. I would argue that it's variation within certain limits or whatever, but that's not the point for right now. That you do see a lot of variation in political forms, but it does certainly feel, at least to me, like there is this big fundamental thing that all of these societies have in common, and that is that they have not in common with earlier forms of class society, that they have not in common with the sort of socialism some of us might hope would replace it. That if you think about you know, if you think about, you know, feudalism or other kinds of directly extractive economies, there does seem to be this really massively important thing that has not in common mm-hmm. with capitalism or, you know, or with, you know, primitive communism. And that does seem like, I don't know. I mean, I'm worried that this is just going to come out, you know, shoe banging, right? You know, that like, I'm just, you know, that, but gosh, doesn't that seem really basic and fundamental?
Yeah, that makes sense. Ben, I would say this was my same intuition, and the reason I decided to do a PhD from a Marxist perspective, explicitly arguing against Weberians. I would just add that reading all of those thousands of pages written by, again, Anthony Giddens, yeah. Michael Mann, Walter Runciman, even people like Joseph Henrich. So not Michael Heinrich, but Joseph Henrich, who is this big polymath anthropologist who has a theory of transition to capitalism that Marxists would say is idealist because it is rooted in normative changes produced by the church. Back in the day, the breakup of the family, the breakup of the kinship structures in Western Europe. But we don't need to get into that. But reading just thousands and thousands of pages over years of historical sociology, non-Marxist historical sociology, just made me think, maybe class relations, very important, but maybe roughly as important as, for example, political relations and other sources of power. I wouldn't argue against you necessarily right now that you're definitely wrong or that my intuition is now completely different than it was before. Just this, my initial intuition, without reading lots of historical sociology, that class cannot but be the most important thing, that definitely toned down and became much more soft. And that is why I guess I would not call myself a Marxist, but if a right winger, or forget about right wingers, if a Weberian told to me, Tibor, there are still shadows of Marxism in you, okay, that could make sense. Yeah, sure. I wouldn't disavow that.
Well, what do you think, Stefan? You wanna leave it there? We got to concede the shadows.
I wanted to talk to Ben about how I think I misunderstand the theory of value.
Mm-hmm.
I'm afraid that my concept of it is exactly what Ben mentioned earlier, like the idea that things have, what was it?
You know, there's a labor theory of stuff that has value that's just right. Kind of really true.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, like, you actually read the first chapter of Capital, mm-hmm. and then and then especially if you start reading that complicated mass of secondary literature that Tibor is referring to. There's a podcast, if you really want to dig it up, where I'm arguing with Andrew Kleiman about this, and he's a very he's a very smart guy, but he's abrasive, I think it would be fair to say.
Yeah.
Not as polite as us three.
But yeah, look, I mean, if you start reading all this stuff, it at least starts to become very clear to me.
No, I'm not going to start reading it because I'll end up not being a Marxist at the end.
Okay, yeah, this is good. It's the medieval Catholic intuition.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's basically like a, you know, like a basic idea of what, like, how value can be used to explain why some products in capitalism or successful capitalist products and why some aren't.
So that's at least an empirical claim. So I mm-hmm. think that's more interesting than mm-hmm. than just the kind of like trivial claim about products. Again, I would argue enough in combination with some of the points that Marx makes later in Capital to sort of ground the exploitation claim all by itself. But I think that it is, and this is a real area of, you know, agreeing with me and Tibor, but look, it is, there's a reason it's wildly controversial among Marxists, how to even understand some of the value claims. What is it exactly that we're talking about? We talk about value. This doesn't mean, crucially, that none of the competing interpretations might be correct.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is not an argument that, hey, look, there's all this disagreement.
That's what people say for ethics, right?
So therefore, they're
right. Wrong,
at least in philosophy 101, they're like, well, there's like four theories of ethics, so they're clearly all wrong.
That's stupid. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So we don't want to say that, right? Mm. But it is enough, at least for me, to want to proceed with extreme caution.
I definitely take Tibor's point that, you know, for instance, when I'm happening to have to defend like Derrida on Reddit as philosophy or whatever, I'll say that, you know, you say he's nonsense, but his interpreters broadly agree on what he says. But if we get to a part of Marx where people, his very deep interpreters who are very clever people, can't agree at all what he says, then it seems we're in dangerous territory.
You're deprived of that argument.
Be other explanations for why that is, but it does seem dangerous in
a way. Yeah, but, yeah. Well, you know, good thing it comes apart from some of the other interesting claims would be my big argument here. I did promise Tibor that we wouldn't keep him for.
I was just going to say that me and Ben can talk about it on off air, and then maybe we'll talk about it next week.
Who knows? Who knows?
Sure.
Things happened. All right. Sounds good.
Thanks, guys. This was awesome. Bye.
Bye.